Hello, I'm Micah. This is KVS Davis 90.3 FM, and you're listening to Book It. The following views presented in this half hour do not reflect the views of KDVS, KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. Yeah, we're back. Just me again. No DJ Drainfield. It's really funny because on the site, it shows that it's DJ Drainfield and me, Micah. But DJ Drainfield is not going to be here for this quarter. So, but yeah, anyways, today, the book of the week is Women, Race, and Class by Angela Davis. Like I mentioned, I've mentioned this in like previous shows for this quarter. We're going to be reading all books like only by women, female authors. And usually what we do on this show is we kind of have like a mixture of different genres. So we'll read fiction books, we've read poetry, we'll read a lot of political theory, or we've read political theory. And today is one of those days. Women, Race, and Class. Angela Davis, if you don't know, which I feel like is crazy if you don't know who Angela Davis is, but you know, some people might not know. She's an American political activist. She's also a professor, I believe, at UC Santa Cruz right now. I'm not too sure on that. I'll look it up. But she was she was an active member of the Communist Party and the Black Panther Party in like the 60s, 70s. Fun fact, actually, at KDVS, we interviewed her in 1969, I believe. So she's been to the station here. But yeah, she kind of, like, rose to fame or fame would be the word. Because during George Jackson's trial in August of 1970, or, no, I guess we didn't interview her in 1969. I'm not sure when, I have to double check that, but yeah, during George Jackson's trial in August 1970, several people were killed during an escape attempt, and the guns that were used during this were registered in her name. And so, as a result, she was kind of, like, put on trial. Or not trial, but she was wanted for murder, basically, because the guns are registered in her name. And she ended up going into hiding, and after that, she was placed on the FBI's most wanted list. So it's kind of a crazy, crazy little story. But she spent 18 months in jail, and her... like time in jail kind of resulted in like the Free Angela Davis campaign. A lot of famous people also spoke out about this, like notably John Lennon and Yoko Ono. They wrote a song called Angela about her. The Rolling Stones also wrote a song called Sweet Black Angel. But yeah, that's kind of how she's super well known, also because of her writing. She's written a lot of books. Probably her most notable, most famous one is Women, Race, and Class. Which I think this book was incredible. I think it's very, very great. Her prose is very simple, and kind of very easy to read. But yeah, it's like very lively as well. There's not like a crazy... how do I explain this? I feel like a problem with a lot of political theory and books that relate to theory and stuff like that is that it's super... The way it's usually written is super, like, not pretentious. Pretentious is not the word, but a lot of higher vocabulary, I guess, is the what I'm trying to say. And so this book feels more accessible to, like, more people because it's written so, like, well and easy. So, yeah, I think that's a great part of the book. But it's incredible. It's actually not a super long book. I think it's just a little over 200 pages. We can check here because I have the book next to me. Yeah, I think for long either. But I will say a lot of the chapters kind of have like a lot of, there's a lot of content to get through. So honestly, I don't think we'll probably be able to cover every single little thing that she talks about or mentions in the book, just because there's just so much information. I think it'd be impossible to try to cram it all into the 30-minute slot that we have for Book It. But I'm going to try to talk about as much as possible. I'm going to go chapter by chapter, probably, trying to explain what she's talking about in each chapter, because each chapter kind of focuses on a different subject, I guess. But yeah, the book is, it kind of focuses... or it's a chronological telling of the history of women's rights movement in the United States from the era of slavery until 1981, which is the publication date of this book. And throughout the book, she kind of analyzes the intersection of three specific topics, which are race, sex, and class. And she divides the book into four primary time periods. The first one being slavery and pre-Civil War. The second being Civil War and post-Civil War. The third being the end of the 19th century and the turn of the century. And then the fourth being overarching historical overviews with references to modern day movements. And you'll kind of see that as I go through the chapters and talk about them. I'm just going to read out all the chapters, like their names. There's 13 of them. Chapter 1 is called The Legacy of Slavery, Standards for a New Womanhood. Chapter 2 is titled The Anti-Slavery Movement and the Birth of Women's Rights. Chapter 3 is titled Class and Race in the Early Women's Rights Campaign. Chapter 4 is called Racism in the Women's Suffrage Movement. Chapter 5 is The Meaning of Emancipation According to Black Women. Chapter 6 is Education and Liberation, Black Women's Perspective. Chapter 7 is Women's Suffrage and the Turn of the Century, the Rising Influence of Racism. Chapter 8 is Black Women and the Club Movement. Chapter 9 is Working Women, Black Women, and the History of the Suffrage Movement. Chapter 10 is titled Communist Women. Chapter 11 is titled Rape, Racism, and the Myth of the Black Rapist. Chapter 12 is titled Racism, Birth Control, and Reproductive Rights. And chapter 13, the final chapter, is titled The Approaching Obsolescence of the Housework, or of Housework, a Working Class Perspective. But yeah, those are all 13 chapters. So I'm going to start with chapter 1 here. Because we don't have very much time, actually. I think we only have 23 minutes, and there's a lot of information. But yeah, so chapter 1 is called, like I said, The Legacy of Slavery, Standards for a New Womanhood. And in this chapter, she starts by highlighting the legacy of slavery among Black people, specifically Black women. A majority of this book is focused mainly on Black women. And she explains that slavery is the one system where women enjoy equality with men in terms of oppression. And she states, Black women bore the terrible burden of equality and oppression. She also states that women were productive in physical and manual labor. And she also states that the rape of Black women was a kind of a power weapon used to demean and remind the Black woman of their femaleness and their vulnerability. Two notable pages, it's page 6 and page 23. I'm going to read out some excerpts. And I want to state before I continue, this is kind of be like a quick overview of the book and the chapters, and a quick discussion, just because there's not a lot of time. There's just so much information, and 30 minutes, well, now we only have 22. 22 minutes is just not enough time to, like, adequately discuss everything. But like I said, this is a book review show, so I'm not going to go crazy about it. But on page 6, she says, but women suffered in different ways as well, for they were victims of sexual abuse and other barbarous mistreatment that could only be inflicted on women. Expediency governed the slaveholders' posture toward female slaves. When it was profitable to exploit them as if they were men, they were regarded, in effect, as genderless. But when they could be exploited, punished, and repressed in ways only suited for women, they were locked into their exclusively female roles. She kind of explains throughout chapter 1 and focuses mainly on women in slavery and how they are treated equally, quote-unquote, to men. And that just means they're being forced to do the same work that men were doing. Even though they were pregnant or they had children to take care of, she also describes, like, how women would take care of their children while working in, like, the fields and things like that. And she describes how some women would wrap their child onto them, and some women were forced to leave their children just, like, laying, like, on the side of the field because they weren't allowed to bring them with them. And she also, goes into detail about, like, pregnant women working and things like that. And she also says on page 7, ideological exaltation of motherhood, as popular as it was during the 19th century, did not extend to slaves. In fact, in the eyes of the slaveholders, slave women were not mothers at all. They were simply instruments guaranteeing the growth of the slave labor force. They were breeders, quote-unquote, animals whose monetary value could be precisely calculated in terms of their ability to multiply their numbers. And that's kind of the gist of what she's talking about throughout this chapter. Obviously, she's going into more detail, Yeah, and on page 23, let me find it here. She says, it would be a mistake to regard the institutionalized pattern of rape during slavery as an expression of white men's sexual urges, otherwise stifled by the specter of white womanhood's chastity. That would be far too simplistic an explanation. Rape was a weapon of domination, a weapon of repression, whose covert goal was to extinguish slave women's will to resist, and in the process to demoralize their men. She also goes on to mention the Vietnam War, and she kind of draws some comparisons there to what U.S. soldiers were doing to Vietnamese women in Vietnam. It was kind of a similar thing where they were raping Vietnamese women in order to demean them, and because they felt that they had the power to do that. But yeah, in chapter, that's kind of like the gist of chapter one. Chapter two, which is called The Anti-Slavery Movement and the Birth of Women's Rights. She discusses the birth of the women's rights movement, as stated in the chapter. And she explains that in pre-industrialization, white women's labor was often limited to the domestic sphere. So they did a lot of their housework, and like work, quote unquote, in the house. So things like knitting or things like, like making clothing, quote unquote typical, early women's work was done in the home. And then post-industrialization, women's role in the domestic sphere became heightened the more that their labor in the domestic sphere became obsolete with the invention of machines. So as machines kind of started to take over a lot of the traditional women's work, quote-unquote, they were kind of being pushed to stay home even more. And this work that these women were doing kind of turned from, like I said, making things like clothing, stuff like that, into more, like, generalized housework, like cleaning and stuff like that, that is kind of more seen today, or associated more today with women's work, or like, housework, I guess. She also talks about women's emancipation and the abolition of slavery and how are they kind of intertwined in the beginning of, like, the women's rights movement. And she kind of discusses the conflation of slavery analogies among white women and working class women, as they felt that their, like, work was akin to slavery. So as working class women worked in, like, mills and things like that, they started to, like, compare, like I said, their work to slavery, which kind of was not the same thing at all. And this also will go into the topic later on, or the topic that she discusses later on, of, like, racism in the women's suffrage movement, and how, like, that kind of all intertwined. She also notably highlights the Gimke sisters. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. It's spelled G-I-M-K-E, but she talks about them, and she quite likes them, because they were ahead of their time, like, on their views of race and sex. They were very, like, anti-racist, sort of, and so a great deal of chapter two is kind of dedicated to talking about them and discussing their, like, role in the early women's rights movement. But yeah, and so chapter three, which is called Class and Race in the Early Women's Rights Campaign, she traces the privileged roots of the Seneca Falls Convention. The Seneca Falls Convention, if you don't know, was a women's rights convention that took place in 1848. I believe it was July 19th to July 20th of 1948. And it was basically, like, there was a bunch of speakers and things like that, and it was a convention. And so that's kind of where Chapter 3 focuses on. She also calls out Elizabeth Cady Stanton for her, like, racist views and things like that, which she will discuss later on in further chapters. But yeah, what else? Let me see. Oh yeah, so she also talks about how, like, the Seneca Falls Convention focused mainly on middle-class white women's concerns of marriage and their exclusion from professional, quote-unquote, fields of work. And this is where she begins the discussion of, like, how the women's rights movement was focused only on middle-class white women. And so she highlights the racism and classism of the early women's rights movement. She also discusses how as, like, jobs or quote-unquote, like, women's jobs began to become, like, more, like, brutal and, like, more... harder. A lot of these jobs started going to immigrant women instead of white women because they were deemed as, like, too rough for white women during the time. She also mentions Sojourner Truth and her speech, Ain't I a Woman, which is a super, super iconic speech. And it's basically her saying to all the women in, like, all the white women of the, like, feminist movement, isn't she a woman too? Because there's, like, a whole, Sojourner Truth is a whole nother, like, thing, but, her speech is super, super iconic, and so Angela Davis talks a lot about her and her role in the early rights movement as well, but yeah, she gave that speech in Ohio at another, convention. She also states that from the start, the women's rights movement in the U.S., had an unquestioning acceptance of the capitalist economic system. She expands on this later on in further chapters where she talks about communism and more economic stuff. But yeah, so chapter 4 is called Racism in the Woman Suffrage Movement. And in chapter 4, she delves more into, like, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and her racism in the movement. And she states that basically, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, she opposed the liberation of black people, especially black men, because she felt that the black liberation would essentially give the black man more rights than the white woman, and to her, that was something that was egregious. She kind of was opposed and would openly, like, speak to, there's a bunch of, like, newspapers and stuff going on at this time, and she would openly, like, be opposed to the black man getting a vote, and things like that. It's kind of crazy. There's a lot of crazy drama in the early women's suffrage movement, and she's kind of, like, one of the main people involved in all of that drama. It's kind of crazy to read about, but yeah. She also like, the beginning of the movement kind of focused on women as a whole, and then as soon as they, like, a lot of these upper class white women or middle class white women realized that, like, black men could get the right to vote, maybe, like, that was being pushed, they completely changed their views and completely went, like, full racist mode and just completely opposed any liberation for black people, and this is kind of mostly what chapter 4 is about. And Angela Davis also talks about how black women weren't even involved in this conversation at all. The conversation was focused mainly on upper and middle class white women and the black man. Black women were completely disregarded throughout the entire thing. Chapter 5 is called The Meaning of Emancipation According to the Black Woman. And she states that after a quarter of a century of quote-unquote freedom, black women were still an oppressed class. And any economic opportunity that they were allowed to participate in, like, job-wise, the conditions were no better than slavery. And that's basically what she talks about throughout most of the chapter. She also highlights the sexual abuse by white employers that black women often endured. And she talks about how the sexual abuse that they endured during this time kind of leads into the myth and stereotypes about black women. And it's really an interesting chapter about how she, and, like, she kind of ties everything together. And then chapter 6, sorry, I'm moving quickly because we have 10 minutes, and there's still, like, 7 more chapters. But chapter 6 is called Education and Liberation, Black Women's Perspective. And like the title says, she focuses mainly on the right to education throughout this chapter. And she also details the women who taught and set up schools for black children, despite public outrage, violence, and threats of jail time. Some notable women that she talks about are Prudence Crandall and Margaret Douglas. Both of these women kind of refused to not teach black children, and they even like took on black children as students despite like being harassed, and it's kind of crazy. We're on chapter seven. Chapter seven is titled Women's Suffrage and the Turn of the Century, the Rising Influence of Racism. And throughout this chapter, she details the efforts of Susan B. Anthony throughout the suffrage movement. And so this chapter is focused mainly on her. And she emphasizes that Anthony, as an individual, she was against racism, but she did nothing to like stop the racist actions of the other figures in the women's suffrage movement. And she often like hid her opinion. She wasn't very vocal about it or anything like that. So she kind of like was a bystander. And she kind of talks about how that negatively affected the movement. And she also talks about how Susan B. Anthony would give in to the demands of the others to not open up the suffrage movement to black women. And then she also talks about throughout this chapter early feminism in the U.S. and how it was capitulated to essentially non-egalitarian demands simply to keep its numbers, as they thought it was safer to like not include black women or any women of color at all. And she also talks about how upper class white women were kind of like unintentionally propping up male supremacy, because they kind of refused to fight for all women's rights, and like all of the racism. It's really interesting how she details all of this. I'm gonna move quickly because, like I said, we don't have very much time, and this is a super super information dense book. Chapter on the rise of black women clubs, and how they kind of started to separate from women's clubs in general because they were very very racist, and that's essentially what the chapter is about. Chapter 9, Working Women, Black Women, and the History of the Suffrage Movement. She basically explains the intricate maneuverings of class and gender that characterize the right for the woman's vote in the U.S. Chapter 10 is Communist Woman. This is a really interesting chapter. It's essentially just an overview of key female figures in communism who are also involved in the women's rights movement in the U.S. throughout this time. She notably talks about Lucy Parsons, Ella Reeve Bloor, and Anita Whitney. There's a bunch of other women that she talks about, mentions in the book, but those are just three of the important ones. The background music is being very weird. Okay, there we go. Chapter 11 is titled Rape, Racism, and the Myth of the Black Rapist. And essentially in this chapter, she talks about the myth of the black rapist. And she basically explains how this myth kind of started during the Reconstruction period, which was like the Reconstruction period. It was a period of time post Civil War from 1865 to 1877. And this is essentially when that myth began. This is a really interesting chapter. She delves deeper into like the sexual abuse of black women by white men and how this also added to the myth of the black rapist. And all of these like stereotypes and stuff, especially the myth of the black rapist, gave way to like the influx of lynchings that began post Civil War, during the Reconstruction and going forward throughout history. They all kind of were like, or this myth was kind of used as the excuse to lynch specifically black men, and that's what chapter 11 is mainly about. Chapter 12 is titled Racism, Birth Control, and the Reproductive Rights, and throughout this chapter she basically goes through the reproductive rights and traces the genesis of birth control rights to abortion rights as it moved along the continuum of race and class. And it's really interesting. And she also talks about not just black women in this chapter, but she also talks about Latino women and just women of color in general. But throughout the book, she like I was saying in the beginning of the show, the book is focused mainly on Black women and their struggle, but she also mentions Latino women quite frequently as well within the struggle for women's rights. And so she, there's a lot of overlap between the two, but specifically in this chapter, she's talking about Black women, Latino women, when it comes to reproductive rights, and she also says immigrant women, but yeah. Chapter 13, the final chapter, is titled, sorry, I have a lot of things written down. Chapter 13 is titled The Approaching Absence of Housework, A Working Class Perspective. And she basically, in this final chapter, she discusses housework, also known as domestic work, which is like, you know, cleaning the house and blah blah blah, like that kind of stuff. Yeah, and she basically talks about how, like, men weren't rushing to the forefront to relieve women of mental, thankless, and repetitive job, or the repetitive job of housework, and there was no volunteering for childcare, and she kind of talks about how women are forced and kind of expected to do all of this without being acknowledged for it. She also goes into the idea of the desexualization of domestic labor. Yeah, and it's really, really interesting. And she also talks about how, like, women cannot escape motherhood, and things like that. And she kind of focuses a lot of criticism on middle class and upper class white women. Yeah, so that was kind of the general overview of the entire book. Like I said, there's a lot of information, way too much information to talk about in a 30-minute show. But the book is very amazing, in my opinion. I see why it's, like, her most notable work. And it's super easy to read. And it's not very long. It's 244 pages. I'd highly recommend checking that out if you'd like to learn more about the women's suffrage movement or the women's rights movement in general, or the Black woman's role in women's rights. It's really, really interesting. I think she's a great writer. Obviously, she's done some things now where it's like, and I think a lot of people think that because of who she is and what she's done for, like, people and, like, what she said, that, like, she can't be criticized for some of her actions now, but that is not true. People can say good things and then do bad things after, and Angela Davis is somebody who deserves to be criticized. But disregarding all of that, the book is amazing. The book is called Women, Race, and Class by Angela Davis. And next week, I believe we're reading Woman Running in the Mountains by... let me see really quick. I always forget her name. It's by... Yuko Tsushima, Woman Running in the Mountains. This is the book for next week. She is notably the daughter of Osamu Dazai, who's a famous Japanese author. Really interesting, but I'll talk more about that next week, or in 2 weeks, so stay tuned for that if you'd like. Thank you for listening. This was Book It. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Bye.
Back out now. This is the days. Dizzy Gillespie, that is. And let me give you some information. If you want to hear some good sounds, the sounds that's round, keep your radio tuned to KDVS in Davis, 90.3 on your FM dial. Look out. Ow! This is the Diz signing off.
Welcome to KDVS 90.3 FM in Davis. My name is Dr. Andy, and this is Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. It's a weekly radio show, a full hour of conversation with poets and pundits, prognosticators, people who care about creativity, people who know how to speak in poetry voice. Every week on this radio show, I bring on two or three fascinating people, most of them authors, some of them of multiple books, who are sharing with us their path towards creative excellence, towards accomplishment in the world of voice, the written word, books with spines. Every week for the last 25 years, I've had the pleasure of descending into Freeborn Hall here at the University of California, Davis, and share with you a radio show like none other. The theme song is A Go-Go by John Scofield. And the theme of the radio show, well, it's largely chosen by our guests. For instance, on this week's show, we'll be joined first by Bill O'Daly. He's translated 9 books of poetry by the Chilean Nobel laureate Pablo Neruda. And then recently, Neruda's first volume, Book of Twilight. He's published 4 chapbooks of poetry. And then in September of 22, his first full-length volume, The New Gods, was released by Beltway Editions. We're going to talk to Bill O'Daly about a reading that he has coming up this coming Sunday, October 27th at 2 o'clock with Bob Stanley, the great poet and publisher, and jazz bassist Terry Cobb over there in Laura Gularte's Poetry in the Foothills series at the Chateau Duvel Winery near Placerville. I read there about 10 years ago. It was quite pleasurable. We had to keep my son Juki from knocking over the bottles of wine. Juki's here with me in the studio tonight. In the second half of the show, we'll hear from Izzy, is the daughter member of the dynamic mother-daughter poetry duo known as Straight Out Scribes. They're celebrating their 34th year performing together.